And one of the things that's just so impactful and powerful when it comes to events is from the perspective of first party data, as compared to something like a white paper or an ebook download. Yeah, you could say that's equivalent to maybe a registration where you have that single point in time action that somebody's taken, but you don't know how much time somebody spent reading that PDF that they downloaded from your website. When they go into that event experience, and it could be virtual, it could be in person, you're getting thousands of data points that you can use to profile and segment your audience base and create follow-up that's actually relevant to things that they care about.
Welcome to the B2B Digital Marketer Podcast, a podcast helping you to end your struggle with digital marketing, helping you to pave a new and better path to target and capture your ideal customer. Each week, we teach you how insiders and experts debunk the dreary and become engines of innovation. Now, here's your host, Jim Rembach.
Okay, B2B DM gang, man, we're going to have a good discussion today because we're going to be talking about something that has had some global shifts. And I'm talking about that from more of a size and magnitude perspective in regards to events, of virtual events, hybrid events, face-to-face events. I mean, whatever you want to look at from an overall event strategy, because we're going to talk about top mistakes that people make in B2B with their event strategies. And we're going to do that with Jonathan Kazarian. Jonathan, welcome.
Thanks for having me on.
Man, I appreciate that. Now, before we get into these mistakes that you often see people make, give everybody a little bit of background about your experience.
Yeah, definitely. So I started Excel Events about 8 years ago now. And frankly, I started it because they're just, when you're planning an event, it's one of the most stressful things you can be doing. And as the event date approaches, you just notice like you're sleeping 15 minutes less every single day. Technology needs to be there to make life easier for event organizers and help them get the ROI that they're looking for out of their event experience. And we built a company around doing just that.
So when you say that, the words that come to mind for me is like augmentation and support, right?
Absolutely.
Enablement. I mean, there's all kinds of things that start coming into play. Well, but with that, yeah, I think what we often find, you know, and talking about that, you and I had talked prior, you know, to actually hitting the record button about how that, you know, things have changed in this world. From it was actually changing, you know, going into COVID, and then COVID just, you know, multiplied it. And I've said this on with other, you know, types of B2B and marketing and sales activities and revenue gen and lead gen. We're seeing all these, you know, shifts occur. And the fact is, it's not going to stop. And there's a lot of reasons for that. And part of it is, you know, a bias of, hey, well, this is how what used to work, right? This is the way that, you know, we used to put these things into play. This is what we used to do in regards to, you know, things that we did ourselves and maybe what we did or didn't, you know, outsource. And there's just the strategy has gotten more complex. So you, with what you do, find some of those common things, you know, as they say, they're kind of like, you know, street fallacies that come across. So if you could just kind of hit on some of the high points, I think we've identified like five or six that we're going to run through. And what you see people approaching you with, and it's like, well, let's look at that a little bit differently. So what do you see most often?
Yeah. And just to even preface that, if you get it right, events are going to be your number one lead gen channel. So we'll talk about a couple of the points where if you can work through these things, you can figure out how to do just that. You know, one of the most common mistakes I see is that people don't have a call to action at the end of their events. And, you know, beyond that, even before they start setting up their event, there's often not much intention that goes into developing that event, not asking, why are we hosting this event? What is the goal? Another thing that we often see is folks look at technology, and, you know, we see this not just in events, but across the marketing landscape. People think that technology is going to be the be-all, end-all solution for them, right? It's not. And you'll see people that will look to a solution that might have something like some, you know, fancy video production tools within it. And you think, okay, well, I can do this myself. But, you know, the reality is you're going to spend hours and hours, probably days, learning how to do live video production, and you're going to get a subpar result. And people undervalue how much time you're spending to learn that when you could be doing something else, focusing on creating a better experience and outsourcing that side of things to the professionals, especially in a world where we're just competing for everybody's time and mind share and trying to put out better and better content.
Well, but there's a common thing. Hold on one second. So let me hit on that a little bit, because a lot of people are sitting out there and saying, in order for you to be successful in today's world, you know, going into 2023, is that your organization has to become a production company. It has to be able to create all this content. It has to do all this stuff from a demand gen perspective. It has to do all these events. And I mean, and after a while, you're like saying, well, there's no way I could resource that, right? Because the complexities that have now come into play, as well as like you were kind of alluding to, is the, you know, the quality of production, you know, and when you start talking about that. To me, that's almost like you're already stepping in the wrong direction if you think that that's what's going to work for you.
Well, exactly. And it used to be that the line was very clear. Like you either had professional quality production or you had what was basically just, you know, a webinar. And today you've got this sort of meshing in between, but it becomes quite obvious when something's not production level quality. And again, the reality is that you're competing not just against what another company is putting out there, but you're competing for somebody's attention and their mind share. You're competing against TikTok or anywhere else that they could deviate off to. So you need to invest in ensuring that that production quality is something that's going to capture their and keep their attention. And the same goes into identifying what you're going to be, you know, who the speakers are the topics worthwhile, investing sufficient time into preparing those topics and making sure that they're really catered towards the audience that you're putting that event on for, which goes back to my previous point is when you're putting that event together, that event is not just, hey, we're going to have a couple of speakers that come together. You need to know exactly who your audience is, what's most compelling to them. I mean, the same thing that would go into any other content strategy. But often when events are produced and put together in that way, especially from first-time event organizers, they're not thinking about the message that they're delivering throughout that event experience.
Well, so you say call to action. When we say that word, yeah, we can just easily just flip that out, right? And say, okay, I get that. But what does that really mean? I mean, because a call to action, if I'm looking at it from a brand, and this is oftentimes a line that unfortunately becomes very blurred, yet shouldn't, is that there's a very big difference between if I'm trying to build my brand and brand awareness versus I'm, you know, really focusing in on lead generation. Those are two different animals. That's like saying, you know, car. You can't take, you know, my two wheel front wheel drive car and go four wheeling with it. But if I had a different car who had, you know, all wheel drive and stuff, maybe I could accomplish that. So when you start talking about call to action, help us understand that dynamic between brand call to action and lead gen call to action.
Yeah. And again, that goes back to why are you hosting this event? And events, you know, they're kind of like an Oreo, right? On the front end, you've got all the Oreo, the stuffing in the middle, right? That is your content, your community that you're developing and putting forward to educate your audience and create opportunity for them. On the front end of that, people are willing to give up their time, their money, their registration data, their tracking data, all in exchange for access to that stuffing, all that good stuff in the middle. Now on the back end of the event, that's where we often see that gap. People aren't really thinking about what's next. And that next action could be something as simple as getting that person to register for the next event that you're hosting. Now this is probably a little bit more in the realm of a lead gen activity. In the brand building activity, I mean, that goes far beyond the event experience itself. And this is actually something that we see event organizers significantly under leveraging. One aspect of that is how are you repurposing the content from that event on social, using it for getting people to register for your next event, delivering it in a sales engagement format to your sales team to educate the prospects that they're working with. And then the other aspect is just that you're establishing yourself as a thought leader in the industry by being able to bring together the other thought leaders in your industry to deliver compelling content. And getting that word out there, and that's going to get you far more impressions than you're going to get during the event experience itself.
Okay. So as you know, I often would talk about the before, the during, and the after the event. And that's really what you're talking about. It's like, you know, yeah, I need to look at that entire, you know, journey or continuum or even relationship piece. And there's another thing that you had mentioned when you started looking at the whole, and maybe provide some insights into that. There's a big difference between somebody who registered and had a particular action or non-action, you know, versus somebody who was, you know, heavily engaged. And I shouldn't put those people in the exact same relation. I call it like calling them relationship funnels. I mean, this person is just kind of like, you know, show up, or not, maybe not even that. They're just information. Where this one, you know, there's some more value exchange that is, you know, could be leveraged, you know, because they're involved. And then their support were involved, and we shouldn't communicate with them the exact same after the event.
Right. And I would actually add, there's a third bucket, which is just the impressions. So, you know, you think about your marketing funnel, it's awareness, your impressions, your registrants, consideration, and then your actual attendees themselves. Mm-hmm. And then within that bucket, one of the other areas that I see a lot of event organizers, you know, having opportunity to improve the experience is just thinking in advance about how they can build sequences and campaigns and ways to re-engage that audience during the event experience itself. And this holds true, be it in a virtual, hybrid, in-person experience. You can predetermine these campaigns and configure your criteria that are going to trigger these campaigns to ensure that you're re-engaging people. For example, if it's a virtual event and you see that, you know, somebody does attend the event, they come and they check out the first session, maybe it's a 5-hour event, and they drop off. You know, they might have meetings, other things that pop up throughout the day. But if you also know, for example, that they registered for 2 sessions in the afternoon and they checked out a certain speaker 4 times, that information can help you build a profile so you know exactly how to re-engage that person and get them to log back in and spend more time with that experience. Now, one other thing I'd want to add to that is, if we're thinking about those different steps in the funnel, it goes back to the conversation of you know, first party, second party, and third party data. And one of the things that's just so impactful and powerful when it comes to events is, from the perspective of first party data, as compared to something like a white paper or an ebook download, yeah, you could say that's equivalent to maybe a registration where you have that single point in time action that somebody's taken, but you don't know how much time somebody spent reading that PDF that they downloaded from your website. When they go into that event experience, and it could be virtual, it could be in person, you're getting thousands of data points that you can use to profile and segment your audience base and create follow-up that's actually relevant to things that they care about. And that's this massive opportunity that we have ahead of us today. And going back to your point around how marketing's changed over the past 2 years, with Apple's war on Facebook and Google tagging in, the third-party marketing mechanisms that we've historically known over the past decade or more, they're just not as powerful as they used to be.
And that's not changing. There's more, you know, privacy opportunities and blocking opportunities. And I mean, you know, now they have, you know, sophisticated browsers where if you just use that, there's no tracking that can happen. I mean, people are being enabled to be more distant and under the cover than they've ever been able to before.
Right. With the exception of once they've actually given consent and they're doing so in exchange for access to your content and community, and it's all being tracked server side instead of client side, then you are getting those touch points.
Definitely. Okay. So, and as you're talking about that, I start going back to the whole, well, if I'm doing the before, during, the after, and I'm just thinking about the execution elements of that, I'm missing a whole strategy part of this that is going to dramatically affect my return on investment. So it goes back to where it was my mind share. You know, if I'm responsible for putting this together, you know, first of all, I can't be last minute. You know, I can't hurry up and do this thing. I start thinking about all of those, you know, common mistakes. So if you could go to your next one as far as a mistake you often see.
Yeah. So with that event programming, you know, we talked about being very considerate of what you're developing for that individual event experience. But you should even take a step back from that and think about your annual event programming. Because that one event shouldn't be everything to everybody. In the historical scenario where if we wanted to justify hosting an event in person, I mean, because, you know, frankly, it's so expensive to do so, we pretty much based it on how many people showed up. And you had some economies of scale where a larger event meant that the cost per person came down a little bit, and that made sense. And then you would have different segments and tracks for attendees so that you could try to develop some relevant content for each party. But the reality is, in the world today, we don't need to do that. We can understand our annual event programming, understand each audience that we want to cater towards, and develop an event strategy for each of them. And that may mean bringing people back together for a couple of pillar or flagship events in person a few times a year. It may also be doing that virtually. Like Zapier is a customer that we work with, and they recently did their annual product launch event. They had people from all over the world, and it was just an incredible way to get these folks virtually to share on social about this massive product launch because they were rolling it all out at the same time. I mean, I've never seen anybody screenshot like a product launch email and post that on social, but the hundreds of people that were doing that for this product launch from the event itself, it was immense. And it was incredible to see just the share of mind and share of media that they were getting for the couple of days of that experience. So as you think about the lead up to that and how to get people into your funnel and how to get sponsors into your funnel, it all has to be a holistic program.
So, and holistic, you say annual program, but for me, I think you've extended well beyond that. Because a relationship, and when you start thinking about sales cycles and all of that, it's beyond a 12-month thing.
It is. It certainly is. We see a lot of our customers thinking about it on an annual basis because of budget, because they're planning their budget for the year. But yes, I mean, you should be thinking multi-year out in terms of that programming, and especially for a growing company where it may not make sense for, say, a Series A, Series B company to host an in-person event, just because their audience isn't necessarily large enough, again, to justify the cost when we think about the variable cost per attendee. You can use virtual as a way to build that audience in advance. And it's going to be a great barometer to understand how many folks you're going to be able to get in person and know who's interested in attending your events. And it's a way to bring your partners, your integration partners, your go-to-market partners into the fold, into the mix in advance. So you already have those relationships in the works. So maybe, yeah, this year, our programming is going to be 7 virtual events. Next year, first half of the year is just virtual. But then in the fall of 2023, we're thinking about that first flagship in-person experience that we're going to be delivering.
Well, as you start talking about that, I start thinking of what variant's going to hit then, right?
Well, that goes to the topic of thinking about technology partners who are going to be able to pivot with you and deliver whatever that experience has to be at that point in time, which also makes the case for using a single provider that enables you to really host all of that data from all of those experiences. Because the type of information that you're capturing from events, it doesn't fit into the box of any CRM today. I say that from the perspective of building these integrations. I mean, we're starting to see like HubSpot introduce the concept of a HubSpot marketing event, which is great. But even the idea of tracking session activity within that doesn't exist today. And I know that's something that they're working on, but that's information that's so powerful when you're thinking about building your nurturing campaigns or handing that information off to the sales team to follow up.
Well, yeah, as you were saying that, I was like, you know, the whole scoring mechanism, right?
Right.
You know, what am I passing on for somebody to now do a, you know, some type of physical, resource heavy, you know, type of activity.
Well, yes. And if you're handing it off to a sales team, it certainly is that. With the topic of scoring, I mean, if you're doing a lead scoring within your CRM, often you're using events or webinars as a mechanism into that scoring model. But even within the event itself, you should be building a scoring program that helps you to understand the engagement of each of your attendees. But the other part of it is that scoring in itself doesn't necessarily tell you what they're interested in. So for example, if you're a company that is launching a new product, or maybe you already launched a new product and you've got customers who are using product A, but you noticed that they're checking out a whole bunch of sessions and workshops related to product B that they're not currently a customer of. you need to have the mechanisms in place to identify and track that, because that's an incredibly powerful mechanism for your account managers and CS team to know who to reach out to and upsell.
Okay. So, gosh, I started, as you're talking, I'm starting to get in, you know, you talk about holistic approach and, you know, we start thinking about the whole entire ecosystem. I start thinking about the relationship between, you know, marketing and sales. I start thinking about the revenue, you know, and revenue ops. I start looking at, you know, all of this, and I'm starting to say that, well, doing these types of things is only for the large companies. And you kind of mentioned that, you know, if I'm a Series A startup or this, that, you know, maybe I should have a different strategy that could maybe lead up to something. So I think fit's very important and expectation setting is very important. You kind of hit on it with the, you know, the Series A type of company, but where should somebody kind of start in this in regards to their thinking? So two things. One is, I'm a legacy company. I've done events before. What do I need to rethink? And then the other one is, I want to launch this and get into this. Because I think those are two very different personas.
So on the topic of the legacy companies, over the past, interestingly, 8 months, we have seen marketing ops folks come into probably 50% of procurement conversations. And frankly, I'm you know, ecstatic to see that. But it's good to see that it's not just us that are thinking that way now, that companies are really starting to adopt that mindset. And I think that there's just, you know, we already talked about it, but like this shift towards the importance of first party data, it's making that more and more necessary. And if you're a marketing ops person and you're thinking about the different avenues you have to capture first party data, nothing competes with events. There's just so many more data points that you're going to be able to capture. I mean, even compared to just website tracking, where somebody might click around on 7 pages of your site once every 2 months, that's nothing compared to what you're going to be able to capture from that event experience.
Well, as you say hold on one second. As you say that, a lot of people from a marketing perspective and a lead gen perspective, you know, talk about intent data and using intent data. So are you kind of saying that this is an alternative or an augmentation, you know, to those types of, you know, or that type of mindset and thinking and data, or is this kind of like what you were talking about, getting into a little bit more granular detail to help you be more focused?
So intent data comes in different folds, right? You've got like first party intent data and third party intent data. And just to make sure we're all on the same page, so first party data is data you capture yourself, you own that, it's proprietary to your company. Second party data would be something like, I host an event, you're a sponsor of my event, and I share information back to you. Third-party data would be something that anybody else can access. Yes, they may have to pay for it, but our competitors have access to the same information that we do, which would be purchasing something like a ZoomInfo or a Bumbora or something like that, where there is intent data. So the information that you're going to be able to capture through these event experiences is going to be that first-party proprietary data that you have.
And then, so therefore, if you strategize properly, you could be collecting the data that helps you to understand whether or not they're a good target.
Yes, in a competitive way and capturing information that your competitors just don't have access to unless they're doing the same thing.
Got it.
And even if they are, they're going to get a different set of customers. So it's not just the intent part, although that's incredibly valid, but it's also knowing not just do they have an intent, but how do we actually follow up with them appropriately? So it's the personalization that comes along with it. And for the earlier stage companies that don't have all of the resources in place, they're still developing the schema of their CRM, for example, and their marketing automation stack. That's okay. That's fine. But you can still start building your event programming and start capturing this information, because it's all going to build upon itself. And it's going to start to essentially snowball to the point where every event has the opportunity to be bigger than the last event, where you have the opportunity and a large enough audience to justify hosting an in-person experience or doing a roadshow and hitting, say, the top 10 major cities in the US. You can get started without having the entire stack in place, and you shouldn't be scared of doing so. And if you think about doing this via virtual events, it lowers the barrier to entry significantly. Yes, you still have to plan a couple months in advance, but it doesn't have to be 6 months in advance. You know, you're not competing with everyone who had the canceled weddings throughout 2020 and 21 for a venue. But if you pick the right tech stack to do so, you're bringing all of this information into a singular location. And when you are ready, you're going to have all that information available to you. And it's all going to be stored in a fashion that's accessible. And you don't have to worry about the ops side of getting that into your marketing automation system today.
I think you just kind of what we talked about as far as the title, top mistakes with B2B event strategies. I think what you're saying is that data is not being leveraged as much as it should. It is not being seen as something that I can make unique. It's not being used after the event as well as it should. There's gaps between sales and marketing. So if we start talking about an MQL versus an SQL, marketing qualified lead versus sales qualified lead, you know, what are the differentiators? And who goes into what, going back to what we mentioned before, relationship bucket, you know, how should I be conversing with these people? And then therefore having all these sequences with that, some of them could potentially, if in one particular group, a lot of it be automated. In another group, you know, maybe it has a little bit more of a hybrid approach, and there's some, you know, physical touches that are not, when I mean physical, I mean live person touches that are associated with it.
Right. Yeah, absolutely. And that's where having the mechanisms in place to alert the right folks becomes so powerful, knowing who those contact owners are and passing that scoring and engagement data over to them, or triggers like somebody checking out another product line that you offer.
Okay, so I got to be smarter about data for sure in a lot of ways. All right, what else?
Yeah. And you know, I don't want that to sound overwhelming, but the other reality is that events, as you mentioned, you know, they've often been thought of as a brand building activity, and they make up 25% of B2B marketing budget. So it's a massive component of that budget. And historically, CMOs, CFOs, CEOs have kind of accepted that. And when I say historically, I mean like prior to 2020, that's changed. And over the past year, 2 years, we've seen event professionals sort of mesh with demand gen folks in terms of the skill set and sort of reskilling. And it's led to this changed expectation of what data becomes available and what you can do with that information. And as that happens, event professionals need to stay aware of that, and they need to be on top of that, and they need to be continuing to up level and partner with the other parts of the organization to make sure that that data is funneling along appropriately. I'm not saying that this should land entirely on the shoulders of event professionals, but you need to know what's available and what opportunities there are so that you can be the advocate within your organization to make those things happen.
Okay. So I was looking at some statistics associated with turnover at the C level in regards to marketing folks, and how the tenure of CMOs is declining, and the turnover rate is increasing at an increasing rate. I mean, when you start looking at this strategy element and component, how much do you think, and I know you could be swagging this, but I think based on what you've been doing, you've probably got a good understanding, is how much has their inability to shift to the new way of doing work contributing to that high CMO turnover rate?
That's a tough question. I've seen some of those stats as well. I think the most recent I saw was average tenure for a CMO was around 16 months.
Yeah.
And it's challenging because it can be hard to develop a program, a marketing program in, even that amount of time. But the transition itself, I don't want to try to make a claim on how that's impacted the tenure of CMOs, but I will say that when you're talking about 25% of your budget being allocated to one channel, that is a massive component of your spend. And if you're not seeing that channel through, from execution through ROI, then yeah, I mean, that justification can kind of be easy to come to. So I think we're already seeing it today where those CMOs are becoming a lot more quantitative in their evaluation of the different channels and the different areas that they're spending money on. And yes, events can be really challenging from an attribution perspective, but the answer in some cases doesn't have to be as discrete. I mean, if you look at even like the way that Google Analytics uses resampling to approximate website traffic, you can take a similar approach to basically resample and approximate the MQL to SQL to opportunity to customer conversion cycle that results from events in the mechanisms or the channels where you do have something that's trackable. Now, that's obviously the case when it's a lead who was already part of your marketing funnel before they engage in that event experience. In the case where, you know, it's a their first touch activity, the first registration, or the first time that contact enters your CRM is via the event, that attribution becomes a lot easier.
Yeah, I think you're kind of talking about the whole strategy piece and the analytics piece. I think the attribution element that you're talking about, that's a whole different animal within itself.
Yeah.
Because of what you're talking about, I've got multiple channels. Where did this person come from? Was it a referral? Was it a, you know, organic? What is it? What was it? And then how did it actually lead to, like you said, ultimately, or how could we actually influence it and put in things in place so that it actually leads to an actual sale?
Right. And in the past, you know, event professionals used to be able to say to their CMO, this isn't measurable. And then the CMO would be able to say to the CFO, well, this 25% of our budget, this channel is not measurable. And that could be the justification. Hmm. So it's like they're almost not even being scored on that. But today that's changed. The expectation is that everything has to have some measurable component to it. Even if it's not going to add up to 100 or be perfect, you have to have some defensible justification for the activities that you're doing and where you're spending money. And that's going to be, in my opinion, even more true over the next 12 to 18 months as we see corporate budgets continue to shrink.
Yeah. I think that kind of leads us into, you know, going forward, you know, to some degree. You know, shifting into 2023, 2024, you know, we kind of talked about the multi-year strategy and I'm like, what variant's going to come next? All of those types of things is, you know, hybrid approaches, augmented approaches. I mean, a lot of people are talking about where they didn't have partner channels before, you know, doing partner, you know, partner strategies and channels, but here's what we ultimately know. And I think this goes back to your first party thing is for an organization to control its destiny. That first party data and that direct sales activity is really what your primary target is. So how much do you see that coming into play as you're helping and supporting people to make these strategies more effective in regards to the whole, because you talked about sponsors, you talked about another stuff, which is a whole different animal. You know, that whole primary and controlling my destiny piece.
It's a massive component of it. It's a massive component of it when you're thinking about events as a mechanism for new business. But the other part of it is that events are an incredible way to bring your customers together, to keep them feeling part of your community, to re-engage with them, to retouch them, to create opportunities for organic conversation between the CS team, the account managers, in a way where you're entering that conversation often without an agenda, because usually those conversations an account manager reaches out, it has an agenda, there's a motive behind it, but that doesn't build a relationship in the same way. So this just creates that organic opportunity. The other thing it does is it puts your customers in front of your prospects so they can talk about all the reasons that you're great.
Well,
and
that's
going forward is the most powerful mechanism you can have.
Well, that's true, but that's also a fine line to dance. You know, and I think talking about the whole strategy element, I think a lot of people can err in that way. And if they're not careful, could actually push a potential prospect away. If they're saying, for example, to their existing customers and preparing them to actually give a testimonial, I think it's better. What I've seen from a psychological perspective is to more have the discussion around, this is the problem I was trying to solve, and this is how it was solved.
Yeah. And maybe this contradicts with what you just said, but we've seen organizations that have had a ton of success by creating workshops where one of their customers can talk about that problem and then create an opportunity for others to ask questions and really understand the way they did that.
That's a very good point. So now, so then I start getting into, or we talked about, well, let's go back to, you have, I think, a few more things that you wanted to talk about from a strategy perspective. So what are some other top mistakes that you see people make with their B2B event strategies?
Yeah. So one of the other things that we see is just when they're thinking about picking a tech provider, they often under-leverage the importance of support. And it's not support from the perspective of, you know, you're going to hit a bug, but in the world of events, like, there's few professions that have the same sense of urgency. You know, obviously, like ER doctors, the military, and first responders. But like when you spend 3 months building an experience that culminates in 3 hours, you don't have 10 minutes to wait for a response when you need to figure out how to do something. So you need a partner, a technology partner that's going to be there in real time to answer your questions for you. And in the selection process, we just see so many customers who, or prospects who you know, we're chatting with because they faced that pain point elsewhere.
Well, as you're saying that, I start thinking about a conversation I had with a colleague of mine. I've known her for about 20 years, and what she is a customer advocate for finding technology solutions, primarily in the contact center and customer service space. And she said that it was a high number. She said she turns away like as many as 80% of her potential customers because they come to her and they're like, this is a problem we need to solve. We've been needing to solve it. And now we need to do it in like 30 days. And she's like, I can't help you. That's not possible. And she has to tell them, we're not a right fit. I mean, do you find something like that where people are talking about, hey, I need to make my, yearly sales now. I'm, 50% down. I need to use this tool in order to make that happen. I mean, do you have unrealistic expectations that come to you all the time?
We're not putting on the event for our right. customers. We're partnering with them to assist them in doing that. But we've certainly heard that internally from folks saying, hey, I need to get, this number of MQLs or SQLs in the door. This is the channel I think is going to be most effective to do so. And we want to do everything that we can to support them in doing that. But that comes back to the conversation of thinking about your annual or extended programming. And what are your expectations around what you're going to be able to bring in the door for each of those experiences? And when do you need to start planning for each of them in order to execute upon that?
Yeah, but my CMO just got canned.
And we've certainly seen that too.
Darn it. Okay. So if I start looking at, kind of putting this all together, and we kind of hit a little bit about the legacy company, we hit it a little bit about the startup company, but I'm sitting here, I've been given this responsibility to put together a better strategy for going into 2023. Where's the first place I really need to start thinking?
If you're an event professional, frankly, protect yourself. Make sure that you're partnering with marketing ops and demand gen so that the leads that you're generating are getting properly attributed back to your activity. Do that at the beginning of your event programming. Then think about what is the annual programming going to look like? What are we looking to accomplish with each of the different events that we're hosting as part of that? What's the format going to be, in person, virtual, or hybrid? And who's the target audience for each of those? Start with that, followed up with understanding what your call to action is from each of those experiences, and you're going to be in a great spot.
Okay, so then here's the other thing, because we've seen a tremendous increase in this, talking about the different roles and the functions within an organization, talking about the new role of, revenue operations, chief revenue officer, trying to bring together the marketing and the sales side and look at all the value that the organization can bring. And that role is really garnering significantly more, power and authority than it ever has before. And so they're looking at, the event strategy quite differently. Maybe I'm not, an event, producer or director or something like that, but I'm a rev person. And now I need somebody to execute on this. What should I be thinking?
Well, we're excited to see that, first of all. And one thing I've seen change a little bit is just I think that role, it's a newer term, right? Over the past 5 years or so. I think at the beginning of that term, it was really just thought about of like where revenue was coming in from, but it's transitioned to be more strategic in the sense of also incorporating what's the cost, what are we spending, what's our CAC per channel. So from the perspective of thinking about that programming, I mean, it goes back to your rev ops person. You're thinking about what are the different quotas of leads, MQLs, SQLs we need to be getting in the door, and where are events going to fill the gap in those different quotas on a monthly or quarterly basis.
Man, I'll tell you, Jonathan Kazarian, a whole lot of things to think about. How does the B2B DM gang get in touch with you?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, we talked about support being our go-to. Head over to our website, excelevents.com. Shoot us a message in the chat. If you don't hear from us in 30 seconds or less, then find me on LinkedIn and let me know about it. It's
calling everybody up, Kazarian
on LinkedIn.
Calling everybody up.
Yeah.
Jonathan Kazarian, thank you for sharing your knowledge and wisdom, and we wish you the very best.
Thanks for having me on.
Thank you for joining us. Go now to join the B2B DM gang in the B2B Marketer LinkedIn group, where you can connect with other B2B DM disruptors and get access to our B2B DM cheat sheets, checklist, and guides. While you're at it, if you found value in this show, please help by going to iTunes to rate, review, and subscribe. And share the show on all of your digital platforms. Be sure to tune in next week for our next episode. And always remember, you can automate your lead capture, but you must lure your lead.